The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. I join you from the coldest room in the Lotus Dieters. This is somehow even colder than it is outside in here, which should be thermodynamically impossible. But nevertheless, we make it happen here. And with my first episode of 2025, I wanted to give you my predictions of what the trends are and how those trends are going to continue to play out over the course of 2025 and what we can expect that to mean for Brokenomics type stuff. I say the first episode of 2025, I did record a Q&A which got lost down the back of the sofa, and you got that last week. But anyway, here we are, the first proper episode of 2025. What is happening and what will continue to happen and what that means. So let's start off with a nice obvious one. The political narratives are changing. So we're going to transition, in only a few days now, perhaps even a few days less when you get to see this, to Trump taking over. It is going to be the rise of the fiscal conservatives. We are getting a new suite of much younger, much more right-wing politicians coming in, certainly in the US. And those trends are also taking place over, much of Europe, not in the UK, obviously. The big losers are going to be progressivism, the woke, but not just on the left. We're not just seeing losers there. The old right, the neocons, the pro-war types, the military industrial contract suppliers, those guys, the Koch brothers, they are all taking a big L this year with the rise of Trump. So I think the first main theme here is going to be the, populists versus establishment. So obviously that's been a big shift. J.D. Vance, Vivek, Elon's influence has very swiftly displaced the Cheneys, the John Boltons, those sort of characters who were basically controlling the right. It was a uniparty, wasn't it? So it didn't make an awful lot of difference. And what we're effectively going to see is a big continual shift in the Overton window. Now, I think my stance on this, and I was having this discussion with Stelios yesterday, is that every party is a left-wing party. The AFD, Reform, they're all left-wing parties. And the reason for that is the entire Overton window has moved so far to the left that even if you're on the right-hand side of the current Overton window, you are still a left-wing party. And that window is going to move. Now, I'm not sure whether we're going to see the emergence of new political forces in 2025, but we are going to see the existing political forces that have a rightward bent, the AFD, the Reform, perhaps even the MAGA coalition as well, are going to find there is free space on their right, which they are going to be able to move into and feel comfortable expanding if that was a bit of their tendency. The Trump coalition, as we saw, we've got the numbers now. We saw Harry won. He did very well amongst independents, moderates, as the US chaps call them. It shows that there is a willingness from the public to embrace the right-hand side of the left-wing Overton window, if you get what I'm saying. This should make it an easy calculation that the correct thing for these establishment parties to do is to start moving to the right. And the left is going to be forced to do that. Whether they will get there in 2025 is a distant question. But we can certainly see, you know, a bit of an upswing in baseness starting to happen all over the board. As I record this, Trudeau has recently announced that he is going to be leaving. That obviously they're going to try and shift. They're going to try and make this transition. It won't matter. Pierre Poilievre is going to win there anyway. The AfD, which has to be incredibly cautious about its approach, they can open this up. Le Pen, I don't know if she's going to make further political gains in 2025, but you know it looks almost certain. The establishment parties are still locking out of the political system anyone that they perceive as a threat. That is a mistake from my point of view because, like I say, all extant political parties are left-wing because they ascribe to a set of assumptions which govern the current paradigm, and all of those assumptions are left-wing. And therefore, if the left wants to win, they should actually embrace parties like Reform AFD and Front National in France, because otherwise, if they continue to lock them out of the system, then people will simply stop playing by the rules. I will leave it as vague as that. And they will find out what genuine right wing looks like. And they're not going to like it. Those pro-war neocons in the US, they're going to find that they're going to be losing a lot of influence. It's now America First is the guiding doctrine. Even Trudeau and Starmer in the UK, on a narrative basis, are starting to make some of this shift. Trudeau has been talking about deportations. Starmer has acknowledged how mass immigration in this country was a big conspiracy to replace us all, which we all knew. But you know, thank you very much for at least mentioning that. But with Starmer, it is of course just messaging because every time he's faced with a challenge, such as the Southport massacre or the gang rape of tens of thousands of children being exposed to an international audience by Elon Musk, his default is to simply say it's all lies and blame the far right. So, you know, obviously it's fake, but they recognise the need to make that narrative shift at an absolute minimum. And actually, isn't it striking how the left simply have, they've just got nothing, absolute nothing. The child gang rape scandal is in full flight at the moment. And, you know, you scroll through Twitter to see what people are saying about it. And the only argument that the left can come up with is to claim that it is lies. Well, evidently it isn't, because we have the receipts, we have the testimonies, we have many, many court cases that have gone through at this point. You know, we've got it in black and white in court records that it's not lies. It actually happened and there was a cover-up. And the left have got nowhere to go on this. There is no... They've got no out. Very unfortunate for them. Even more unfortunate for the UK that we've recently just had our election. And before that, we had a nominally right-wing party. So our political revolution is going to have to be postponed a bit. But perhaps that is a good thing, because now that the Tories have been so completely discredited, Labour are trashing their reputation at a rate of knots. They only got 20% at the last election. And apparently they've already alienated a quarter, at least, of their voters, people who actually voted for them in the last election. So, you know, this has happened before in the early 19th century. The old Whig Party, the old Liberal Party, which is not the same as the Liberal Democrats, but the old Liberal Party, they replaced a hated Tory government and managed to be even worse and managed to get themselves destroyed and replaced by the Labour Party. You know, perhaps something like that is coming as well. We can hold out hope. But, I mean, you know, essentially the problem is that the left won everything, you know, from you know, basically the early 2000s onwards, they enjoyed complete cultural victory. You know, if this was a video game, the end screen would have popped up by now saying you win. And because they won, they get to... basically indulge their worst instincts, which, given they're lefties, is very bad indeed. And you never know quite how bad it's going to get with the left. Quite often it's famine. But on this occasion, in this period of history, they decided to behave like Kronos, the Greek god who devoured his own children. So, you know, we've had a doctrine where we must let our daughters be raped by immigrants and we must castrate our sons. you know, it was quite mad, but that was the point they get to, and it's obviously undefensible, and anyone who has even a slight brain in their head is not going to go for it. So they've got nowhere to go. They are going to continue to fail. Do I predict that they are going to get their house in order and they're going to cluster around something like Clinton-style, you know, left-wingery, you know, Clinton-style Democrat? Will they make a return to that? I suspect not, because they are so locked into the woke. You know, woke has got escape velocity at this point. You know, nothing is stopping that train. That they have to make that return to Clinton-style Democrats, but I don't think they're going to achieve it in 2025. Let me know in the comments if you think that they can speed run a return to Clintonism. I sort of doubt it myself. Other interesting thing, Battle of the Billionaires, of course. We've got to look at the, you know, the elites, the power behind the throne. Well, Musk is up, obviously. The tech bros are up. You know, Mark Andreessen is, you know, been making some great points. Mark and Elon are both former Democrats. I mean, there's a whole swathe of tech bros who are, you know, on the up at the moment, and they are very keen because they are essentially tech accelerationists. And it was impossible to achieve anything under the Biden regime. So a new class of billionaires is circling in. Who is circulating out? Gates, Bill Gates, George Soros. You know, these people are rapidly losing influence. And on the right, as I mentioned, is it the Koch brothers or the Koch? I never remember if you pronounce it Koch or Coke. But anyway, the second largest private company in America, Koch Industries or whatever it is, they do oil stuff, generate revenues of over $100 billion a year, have basically dominated the Republican Party for, you know, perhaps 30 years, and it's cost them billions to do it, but they've basically been able to shape right-wing politics for decades. And clearly, their influence is over, certainly at the top level. I'm sure they still have influence at you know, the intermediate levels, because, of course, 30 years of buying people doesn't go away in one election cycle. But there has been a cycling of elites in the background, basically from old money to new money. Well, you know, another way of looking at it is from old families or boomers to Gen X. Which is very interesting. That is a theme I must explore at one point. Let's quickly touch upon, while we're on the billionaire subject, Elon's H1B1 whatever the visa situation. I was out of the Lotus Eases office when that was going on, so I didn't give my take on that. I have studied Elon quite closely because I went quite large on Tesla stock when it was $12 a share back in 2019. And he wasn't as active as he is now. But, you know, back then, you know, in my due diligence, I watched basically every interview that he'd ever given. And I think I've got a fairly good idea as to how the man's mind works. He's not like the rest of us. He runs at 1,000 miles an hour at all times. He has this sort of relentless pace, and it has allowed him to become, you know, the most successful man on the planet. He's achieved more than possibly anyone ever, with, you know, possible exceptions of Alexander the Great and a few others. But, you know, he has achieved a remarkable amount during his lifetime. And he does it by being, as I say, 1,000 miles per hour on everything all the time. So I don't think that he actually wants to demographically replace, you know, US. He simply wants to solve his engineering problems as fast as he possibly can. And that means he just wants to grab whatever assets immediately. Now, if he had delivered something first, if he had, you know, worked with Trump and, well, I mean, he Doge is not directly associated with deportations, but if we had got something like 10 million deportations out of the US, and they had changed the gatekeeping that basically stops young white men and increasingly young Asian men as well. Asian mean, I think, it's different things in the US and the UK. In the UK, for some reason, it means Indians, but, you know, Asians, I think, in the US still means, you know, sort of Chinese, Japanese types, all that sort of thing. Young white men and increasingly young Asian men were being purposefully excluded on the basis of DEI. And that's part of the reason why you don't have that network of young engineering talent coming through, because they have been kept out. If he had delivered those changes and, you know, the 10 million deportations, and then asked, okay, for a couple of years, I've still got a shortage while this works through the system, can I have some Indians, please? I think people would have gone with that. But he's too autistic. He's too short term. He's running too fast, and he didn't really think it through. So I do forgive him. He's been absolutely blindingly brilliant on the child rape gang stuff. He has been truly superb on that. So I forgive him for the Indian visa stuff. I don't mind a little bit of, you know, taking the best and brightest from the rest of the world. But it does have to be the top 0.1% of IQ and ability, which actually is a pretty tiny amount of people. So I'm not too bothered if it's a tiny amount of people, as long as all the, you know, the mass stuff comes to a swift end. Perhaps I shouldn't say this, but you could also make the argument that if the best and brightest of the rest of the world stayed in their home countries, they could probably achieve a great deal there. And I just think if the very best and brightest of Indian engineering talent stayed in India, quite possibly within a decade, they could invent toilets. So I don't think it is as simple as Elon first put it, found it. But nevertheless, it's like that old Lenin quote: when you push the bayonet, if you find steel, back off, and if you find mush, keep pushing. What Musk did is he found steel when he tried to go down the visa thing, and he found mush when he went for the child rape thing. So he swiftly pivoted, and I think he's done very well. Right, moving on. Semi-moving on. I've got a question, and I might do a Lotus Eaters podcast segment on this. It's an idea that I've been thinking about. If I'm predicting that woke is going away, and that there is going to be a rise of the right, of the based, and this is going to have popular support from the independents and moderates, so it's going to be a genuine shift of the Overton window, and it's a rising trend, and all the tech bros are behind it, and all that kind of stuff, and it becomes the thing. Well, what did we see for the last 20 years? The thing was woke, and woke got corporate sponsorship. So you can go to any of the big corporations, any of the big banks, and they will have basically an office of woke within them. You know, I looked at the JP Morgan example, but JP Morgan literally have they call it an LG. T, B, plus, I forget it now. You know, the alphabet stuff. They've got an office of alphabet stuff where they basically bring in people on corporate banking salaries and say, it's like, okay, so here's you know, 120 plus grand a year. Do woke stuff, and so that we can put it in our annual report at the end of the year that we're doing woke stuff. And that corporate sponsorship of the left ended up completely neutering them. I'm old enough to remember Occupy Wall Street and the messaging around that, and it was nothing like what modern woke looks like. The corporate sponsorship hollowed out the left and wokeness. So my question, which I've been pondering and what I want to come back to, is what happens if the corporate world wants to start sponsoring based? What if they want to have an office of based? What if they come to the Lotus Eaters and say, we would like to sponsor your work and give you money? Should we take it? Now, it's probably a slightly easier question for me, but most of those lads out there don't own a house. And if somebody rocks up and says, we would like to sponsor you, and here's 500 whatever grand a year, and that means that, you know, the poor chaps can basically afford a house, and we can expand operations and hire more people, and, you know, launch Lotus Eaters US, and, you know, do all the other things that I've got on my list of business development projects that we are, which we are working through as best we can with limited resources, you know, that's going to be hard money to turn down. But you just got to be careful because you see what happened to the left when they got corporate sponsorship. That's an idea I need to develop. Please give me any sensible thoughts on that in the comments. And that one I want to keep, you know, rattling through my mind until we, you know, settle on something that's really worth saying on that. Next up, let's do some quick fire on some big trends to see where we are on them. So number one, let's start off with crypto. I've talked at some length on Brokenomics about, you know, what I'm expecting from Bitcoin and you know, crypto more broadly in 2025 in the liquidity cycle and all that kind of stuff. Not going to repeat that here. Not really the focus of this particular episode, but I will make some supplementary points around them. Big one possibly being stable coins. So these are basically coins that try and trade one for one with their underlying currency. So, you know, examples like USDC and USDT basically try and so that $1 equals one of USDC. So it is a literally just a dollar, but on crypto rails. The US government wanted to dislike them under Biden, but found that they couldn't. And the reason that they couldn't is because the way that they duplicate the dollar is they go out and buy US treasuries to back the dollars on the crypto rails. And because they had grown so fast, what that meant was that one of the biggest buyers, not yet the biggest buyer, but close to being the biggest buyer of US debt is stablecoins. And the US has an awful lot of debt that it needs to sell, and therefore it found itself in the position where it simply couldn't, you know, be too harsh with these guys. But Trump's whole approach to crypto is very different. He's an enabler. He's an accelerationist on the tech front. That's why all the tech bros backed him. So a proper regulatory framework for crypto is likely to emerge. That didn't happen under Biden. The closest thing to a regulatory framework was basically enforcement via prosecution. So they'd never tell you what you could do. They would simply say nothing until they decided to prosecute you for doing something that they didn't like, which they couldn't for some reason tell you that they didn't like it beforehand. They just do it all that way. Trump is committed to laying down proper rules so that the companies actually know what they can do. Mark Andreessen was talking about this on Joe Rogan not so long ago about how there was basically a war against anything crypto related, and that was being pushed through the banks. You know, anybody who had crypto in their job title would find they just lost their bank account, which is, of course, hugely disrupting. You know, the enforcement through prosecution, as I talked about, all of that is going to change. There's going to be a framework put in place. These companies know what they can do. They can get on, they can build, they can accelerate. Why do I focus on stable coins, though? Because, well, put it this way. Visa does something like 4 trillion in transactions every year, and stablecoins are already up to more than double that. So even under the Biden regime, which was hostile to this stuff, they've doubled Visa. And I don't think a lot of people have quite twigged just how fast this stuff has moved, even under a hostile regime. So what's it going to do under a positive regime, where they actually know where they are and the companies can adopt it seamlessly? You know, I mean, the obvious benefits are that it's faster and far cheaper. So companies can move around money, and instead of paying, you know, 3% to Visa or whatever, they can basically do it for a tiny fraction of a percent, and they get final settlement quicker. You can use it in all sorts of businesses. A good example of this is going to actually be El Salvador. So in El Salvador, they made it a legal requirement to accept Bitcoin. So you can go into a McDonald's or, you know, a hardware store and buy stuff with Bitcoin using the Lightning network on your phone. So, you know, all the big chains like McDonald's and whatever else, I mean, they all have branches over there. They've all been forced to adopt it. So they've got a case study of how it actually works in the real world. And of course, they will be well aware that, oh, my transaction costs have just gone from 3% to virtually zero, and it works, and I get final settlement, and it's fine, and I know how to account for it. there's nothing to stop them wanting to roll that out across the rest of the world because of those benefits. So it really could be quite fast in 2025 that stablecoins or possibly Bitcoin on the Lightning Network becomes a thing that just pops up in your local shops because they've got no reason not to do it and they've got lots of reasons to do it. So that could be quite an interesting change that you would see with your own eyes. There's other case studies as to why it's very valuable. The easiest and best example I can possibly think of, I mean, there are many examples in the corporate world as to why you want to be able to move large sums of money quickly and cheaply. But a really good example is Australia. The reason is because the US is moving from T+3 to T+1 settlement. What do I mean by that? So when you do, say you buy a stock, you've got the transaction plus 3 days to basically get the money in. Why is it 3 days? Because when this stuff started, people were on horses. And basically you would do your trade, and let's say you did a trade just before the end of the day. You know, the next day you could write a check and put it in a post, and a man with a horse could get it to the settlement house and it'd be processed in 3 days. You know, that was sort of the minimum amount of time that they needed to do it. In a digital age, they basically decided, well, it's all going electronically, so therefore we don't need to do this on T+3, we can do it on T+1. Why is that a problem for Australia? Well, because a lot of their stock trading is going to be with the US market, and because of the time zone differential, basically that T+1 has already expired before they're able to do anything, even electronically. They just can't process it that quickly. So the only way that they can do it is to adopt stablecoins. There are many, many other examples that I could give you for, you know, corporate treasuries and all the rest of it, but that one just makes the point so clearly. You are going to see crypto emerge into your daily life in the stores, and the corporates are going to take it on, and the banking sector is going to take it on. So that is going to be a huge acceleration, which I think is worth noting. There's no point, well, unless you need to use them, buying stable coins, because you're not going to see any upside because it is literally pegged to the dollar. So, you know, the more people that buy stable coins just means they create more stable coins to keep it at 1-to-1. You could potentially buy into the underlying companies like Tether that offer them. But nevertheless, I think that is a fascinating trend and will have knock-on effects for other crypto industries, which you will no doubt be talking about through the course of 2025. Right, what else have we got? AI. Yes, we should talk about AI. What's the point I want to make? The point I want to make here is that in 2024, there was enormous infrastructure spend into AI and very little to show for it. So the infrastructure spend was happening, the capabilities were being built, but what you didn't see is companies spend X many billion and get their multiple applied to that. You know, a business is its capital, and it should generate a multiple of that capital going forward, and that capital was being spent, but it wasn't generating a multiple. So you weren't seeing the evidence of AI. I think now because that has been built up, you will start to see that applied. What does that mean? Well, I think we're going to get into a very interesting dichotomy here, because the biggest companies in the world, you know, the Mag 7, as they call them, you know, the seven biggest companies, they are able to be at the cutting edge of this stuff. So I think your sort of Googles and Amazons and, you know, Apples and so on are going to be able to take full advantage of it and stay at the cutting edge and have products and continue to lead. Then you've got most of the middle, which has a traditional cost structure, is not at the cutting edge, and they will be able to be replaced by new startups that can do what they do, only with significantly less people and capital spend. So as much as the fact that the world's largest companies on many metrics look overvalued and there's too much capital allocated to them, I don't see what stops that trend for now and possibly at all in 2025. So I wouldn't be surprised if that continues. And I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of those middle-sized companies end up being disrupted. I mean, especially companies like, the consultancy companies, the Accentures and Peets, whatever it is, PKW, whatever they call themselves now. Those consultancy businesses, you can basically, instead of hiring, one senior project manager and a bunch of overpaid 25-year-olds to come in and tell you how to run your business, you can basically just get an AI to do it for you. That's going to be hugely disruptive. The other big change that you're going to see in AI is that so far it's basically been a bit of a toy. You just ask it a question, it pops something out very quickly. But that's a bit bonkers, really, when you think about it. Because, I mean, if I asked you, do you prefer jam or marmalade? You don't need to think that long. You just give me an answer. If I asked you to diagnose the sociological trends that have been driving Western decline, you're probably going to need to think about it for a bit before you give me your answer. These two things are not equal. However, the way that AI has been working at the moment is that no matter how easy or difficult the question is, it thinks for about the same amount of time and then spits out an answer. What we're starting to see now is the emergence of models that will have some deep thinking time and will produce significantly better answers as a result. This will be particularly the case when they load these AIs into proprietary systems within businesses, because then they can say, okay, well, do multiple cycles, take 10, 20 minutes, a couple of hours, or even possibly you can say, look, this is the biggest problem facing my company. Here is all of the data related to it. Here's $100 million worth of servers, GPUs and CPUs dedicated to the task. Think about it for 2 months and then give me your answer. It's starting to sound a bit like the supercomputer in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy now I think about it. But you get the idea. You're going to see the emergence of AI which is less gimmicky and actually much more focused on delivering genuine results. There is actually a version of this. I think it's Google Gemini Research product or something like that, where it's starting to do this. Rather than give you a very quick answer, what it will do is you ask it an answer, it will break that, you ask it a question, it will break down that question into the subcomponents necessary to arrive at it. And then, because it's backed by Google, and Google are quite good at this with their searches, it will go off and search however many websites it needs to search in each thing, and it will search hundreds of websites, potentially pull live data, and it will come up with a well thought through basically report. And the kind of stuff that it can give you is kind of equivalent to what you might pay one of these consulting companies to do, only they would charge you 80 grand and spend 2 months on it, and this thing will do it in 10 minutes. So it, as you start to get more of that, huge disruption for the professional industries, huge impact for businesses that are able to leverage it properly. While I'm on this vein, it's probably also worth talking about, what are we actually going to see from AI? Are we going to see a winner takes all as had been assumed? Or are we going to see, point cases for this? So, Google, because they're so good at search, can give you real world thought through reports like this. OpenAI, hopefully from their point of view, they maintain their innovation edge and continue to lead. If they don't, they might have a problem. But, what is going to be the differentiating edge for OpenAI? Grok, Elon Musk's one, is going to be differentiated on the basis that it doesn't have anywhere near as much woke assumptions built into it, so should be more honest. It'll just be interesting to see how that starts to differentiate out, because at the moment it's kind of a random pick which one you use when you've got a question. But they might start, we might just start to see maturity of this industry, which could be very interesting. AI infrastructure is continuing to build out. I think it was one of Elon Musk's company where he basically, was it Elon Musk or was it somebody else? Well, basically they strung together 100,000 GPUs. 100,000 GPUs into an AI cluster, something that had previously been thought impossible because the error rate starts to shoot up as you chain these things together. But they solved that. They put them all together. Again, what could that unlock when you apply it to genuinely difficult problems that these companies could be having. So that is going to be significant. Let's look at the losing side of this equation. The losing side of this equation is going to be legacy businesses.
If you would like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.